That was a very nice segue to my presentation, where I will be talking a lot more about some of the data challenges that we face. I'll spend a lot of time talking about some solutions to those data challenges and attempt to provide you with some tools and approaches that you can take home. And then lastly, I'll conclude with what I think some of the real benefits are to approaching data management with a real vision of stewardship, and how that can benefit the science and society as well. So some of the key challenges I think that we all probably recognize are illustrated in this one slide here. In the upper left, I think everyone in this room is probably increasingly doing much more interdisciplinary, multidisciplinary work that is attempting to address some of the grand challenge issues that we face in science and society today. These types of studies require access to a broad variety of data, often extending back decades in time, so we can look at changes over temporal periods as well as across space. In the upper right is a fairly recent paper by Tim Vines, who looked at the loss of data over time associated with publications. So if you go back and look at publications extending back 20, 30 years, around 20 years or so, you go back that far, we have access to less than 50% of the data associated with those studies. This is for various reasons, including the data were lost, the metadata were not adequate, some kind of a mishap made the data unavailable, or in some cases, the principal investigators are just totally unavailable to provide those data, and they're not available through an open archive. In the lower right, this is from a study that you'll hear more about later this week in a session that Carol Tenneper is involved in, I believe on Wednesday. And this was from a paper in 2011. It was just recently updated this year with some follow-up work to look at changes in attitudes and perceptions towards data management in the environmental sciences community at large. But I would say that some of the trends still hold true. And if you look at this one particular slide, it is over 1,300 environmental scientists from an array of different disciplines and domains were surveyed for this. And they were simply asked, what metadata standard do you use for documenting your data? And over half said they did not use a standard. The next highest response was, well, I use a standard, but it's one that I created in my own laboratory. So one might argue that that's probably not a community-based standard. And very few of them actually use some of the more commonly known standards like ISO, 19115, EML, and various others. And then one of the other challenges that I think we're all faced with is recognizing that data loss and data unavailability is a challenge. The federal government, actually starting back in the Clinton administration and then proceeding through the Bush administration and then most recently in the Obama administration, have really been pushing for more open government. And the particular initiative is called Open Government Initiative, and it is focused on making sure that data that are funded through federal research dollars are available for use by the scientific community as well as society at large. This next year, we're going to see some significant strengthening of the Open Data Initiative guidelines. This will be coming out in a whole variety of different announcements and memos from virtually every research sponsor in the U.S., as well as many internationally that have adopted many of the U.S. guidelines. So what are some of the solutions to the challenges that I mentioned, as well as Sylvie mentioned in her talk earlier, the long tail distribution of data, long tail loss of data, and so on? And I'm going to focus on a couple papers that I'll provide references to at the end of the talk, so you don't need to necessarily write this down now. But I want to focus on the research data lifecycle, the research lifecycle, and how that interacts with the data lifecycle. And in particular, I'm going to focus on 10 simple rules or steps for creating and implementing a good data management plan, which I would argue is really central to being able to provide good stewardship for data, as well as making data available for use more broadly. So we look at the research lifecycle. We're all pretty familiar with that. This is a very, very simplified version of that. But you can think of, you know, the first thing is we formulate ideas, we identify hypotheses we want to address, we document those. Secondly, we go out and acquire data. Third, we analyze, visualize, and interpret the data. And then fourth, we publish and disseminate findings, as well as hopefully the data as well. The data lifecycle is, again, this is a simplified version. There are lots of different alternative views of this. But arguably, it starts off with a plan for how you're going to manage your data. Secondly, discovering existing data. Typically, all of us have to discover meteorological, climate, other soils data that might be available to us or meet our particular needs for study. And then collecting and organizing new data, unless we're simply doing a meta-analysis based upon prior existing data. Assuring data quality entails a whole variety of quality assurance, quality control mechanisms. Describing the data, this means adding the metadata to the data so that the data can be interpreted down the road. Then using the data, preserving the data, and sharing the data. So this entire life cycle is really intimately associated with the research life cycle. And what you see in the yellow are the 10 simple rules or 10 simple steps that I'm going to cover in the next few slides. So first of all, it's really important, as we all know, to understand what the requirements of the research sponsor are. There are, last count, I think 36 different research sponsor requirements for data management plans. And these are just a few of the research sponsors that I highlight here. Some of them are quite complex. The National Science Foundation alone has, last count, I think 11 or 12 different templates that they might require depending upon which directorate or which division within a directorate you're applying to. Others are more standardized, like USGS. And then we've heard a lot of, in the previous talk, about the National Institutes of Health and their focus on supporting access to data for the long term as well. There is a great tool. I don't know how many of you are familiar with, how many of you have used the Data Management Planning Tool or DMP tool? Not very many. Okay, a few hands. I highly recommend that you check this out. This is a free tool. You don't need to belong to a particular institution in order to use it. It has the templates for all the major research sponsors in the U.S. And what the tool does is it helps step you through the process of creating a data management plan that meets all the requirements for a particular agency. So oftentimes there are 4 to 6 types of requirements that are included in a data management plan set of requirements from a research sponsor. This program will actually step you through creating that. It'll provide a lot of good examples in terms of responses that you might want to think about providing to include in the data management plan that typically gets submitted along with the proposal back to the research sponsor. The other thing that is nice is there are now over a couple hundred different universities and other agencies and so on that are members of the DMP Tool Consortium. And a lot of them, like my university, University of New Mexico, and probably a lot of your universities as well, if you're from an academic background, have recommendations that they provide as well that you can access by simply signing in through your university login, and then that will also help step through providing good responses to the requirement templates. Why this is important is that many of our universities have, like, internal data archives, possibly additional sources of help and so on that can go into helping us create and implement a good, solid data management plan. One of the things that's really nice about the DMP tool as well is the fact that lots of people publish their data management plans on the DMP tool website. And you can do this one of several ways. You can either publish it so that anyone in the public can look at your data management plan, or you can simply publish it so that everyone associated with your institution, your university, or whatever can look at and access the plan. But this is a great source of information to find out better ways to manage data, as well as typically identify some tricks of the trade that you may not be aware of unless you look at some other plans that have been submitted to the same sponsor that you may be submitting a proposal to. The second step is to identify the data to be collected, the types of data, the sources, volume, and data and file formats. Why is this important? Well, for several reasons. One, it costs a lot more to manage a data effort that's comprised of multiple terabytes of data versus one that's simply a small number of Excel spreadsheets, for example. The types of data can be very important in that you may need a geographic information system, for example, to hold and manage and analyze geospatial data, for example, or a sophisticated database package to deal with very complex sets of data tables. Oftentimes, these come with different price tags for the software and so on that are needed, as demonstrated here. So the next step is to define how the data will be organized. Again, will it be organized in a spreadsheet? Will it be in an available database package like Access or FileMaker or something more sophisticated like Oracle or ArcGIS, for example, for geospatial data? So I just wanted to highlight this because a lot of us use spreadsheets for managing data, and some of the references I point to will also help develop, show you, to point you to some better practices for this. But I'm an editor for a data journal, and I often am sent spreadsheets that really represent what might be viewed as the spreadsheet from hell syndrome, and that they have lots and lots of problems associated with them. So my screen up here is a little bit hard for me to see, so I'm going to have to turn around and point out a few things. But you can, if you can read this, probably on one of the larger screens, you see that there are some real challenges associated with this particular spreadsheet. For one thing, it's not a single spreadsheet, it's three. Three different spreadsheets are embedded in this one spreadsheet. In addition, the labels, I think the label on this is data.xls. That's not particularly useful and helpful, but many of us, I would argue, if you go and look at your laptop, you'll probably see lots of similarly described or defined titles for your Excel spreadsheets. In addition, there's a whole mix in terms of answers here. There's lack of consistency, let's say, with respect to dates. Quite often I see spreadsheets that are submitted where lots of the cells are colored different colors, and the colors have some meaning that aren't documented in any way, shape, or form. So I see a lot of people nodding their heads here. But anyway, this is a real challenge when you're trying to create a preservation-ready data set that can be used by others over the long term. There is a simple solution to this that I just want to introduce you to. This is a tool that's been developed by Data One and the University of California and several of our partners. It's called Dash, and this is it's a combination of a way to submit a spreadsheet to an archive so that the data are available for broadly to the public, and it does several things. When you submit or upload your spreadsheet to Dash, it does an immediate integrity check of the data. So it's going to look for problems or potential problems with your spreadsheet. It'll point to things like colored cells or embedded graphics or multiple embedded spreadsheets within a single spreadsheet. as well as lack of consistency in the columns, for example, the date example that I showed previously. So we'll help step you through the process of cleaning those up, and it provides an opportunity to enter in additional metadata that can help better describe those that spreadsheet. And then lastly, with a simple click of a button, you can then archive the data and the metadata describing the spreadsheet to an open repository for long-term preservation. So the fourth rule is to explain how the data will be documented, and there are several approaches to this. Clearly, lots and lots of standards that exist, as well as many tools, and I'll introduce just a couple here. The first is in the upper right. This is from the Knowledge Network for Biocomplexity. The tool is called Morpho, and it's for managing both data and metadata, typically tabular data sets, but can also deal with geospatial data as well. And what it does is it provides a wizard that, again, will help step you through the process of creating really good metadata for your particular data set. And then the package then can be archived in one of multiple different repositories as well. This provides pretty comprehensive metadata that can cover any aspect of documentation that you might need for a particular project or particular data set. Lastly, and many of us may not be aware of this, but let's say once you complete an NSF study and you submit your final reports and so on, you are legally required to make those data available to anyone that requests those within, let's say, minimally a year after the project has been completed. This will probably be tightened up as well. The data, quote, as defined by the Office of the Inspector General at NSF, includes not only the data that might end up in tables and so on, but it can also include the notebooks of your undergraduates, your graduate students, postdocs, or whatever that were managing data for some aspect of the data lifecycle, research lifecycle in your laboratory. So one solution to that is IPython. It's an open laboratory notebook. It's a great way to document laboratory and field and other types of procedures along the way, and it makes it then easy to download that and include that as part of the documentation for a particular project or particular set of data sets. Again, I wanted to just point you to Morpho. This is available by simply looking for ecoinformatics.org and then Morpho or Morpho Data Management or Morpho Metadata. But it's a wonderful tool that's quite easy to use, again, largely with tabular data, but increasingly with other different types of data as well. The fifth rule is to describe how data quality will be assured. And this is one thing that most data management plan templates for various research sponsors now require or are increasingly requiring. So such things as what level of training goes into making sure that the technicians and the students that are working with your data are doing things in a consistent manner from one person to another. What instrument calibration and verification tests are being used. Double-blind entry is quite often recommended for entry of manual entry of data. And then there are lots of other approaches for acquiring data as well. And then, in particular, with respect to detecting errors and then ways to resolve those that all fall under the QAQC umbrella, those need to be mentioned as well. So, the sixth rule is to present a sound data storage and preservation strategy. And there are really three questions to be asked here. How long will the data be accessible? How will data be stored and protected during the project, and how will data be preserved and made available for future use? And there are several solutions to this that I will, or tools that can be used, and I'll go through these in some of the next few slides. So with respect to data preservation, there are several rules of thumb here. First, it's great important to have a clear backup policy and review this frequently within your laboratory. Don't assume that backups are automatically being performed by your university or within your laboratory or your agency. Third, use non-proprietary standard formats. Again, if you try and access data that were created 20 years ago using Excel version 1.0, I would argue you probably cannot read that in any way. Fourth, how many of us assume that our backup strategy works and don't check it? It really is important, if you do have a backup strategy, to at least on a quarterly to 6 month basis go and look at those archive or backed up files to make sure that your backup strategy is in fact working as you thought it was. And then lastly, there's a very simple rule that I and lots of other people recommend, and that is to have at least 3 copies of your data in at least 2 locations. Now, this can be on the original computer in your office with a backup that's maybe in a storage device that's in a fireproof safe or a fireproof cabinet, and then one offsite backup that's maybe at a home or another collaborator's office in a different building, for example. It's a great way to ensure or better ensure that data will survive some kind of a catastrophic loss. In terms of archival, if you don't have an archive associated with your university or your particular agency, then there's a great way to find out about archives that do exist. This is through re3data.org. This is a merger with DataBib, and this now houses information on over 1,200 data repositories worldwide that might meet your particular needs. And here are just a few examples of some of the repositories that are part of the catalog. Again, it's very easy to search through these and find ones that relate to soil, agronomy, and so on. Another one that was briefly included in one of the slides from the previous speaker is Dryad. Dryad is a relatively new repository that publishes or archives data associated with scientific publications from a large number of journals, including many in the environmental sciences. So this is, again, I would encourage you to check out the website here. Many journals automatically point to Dryad, but if you want to archive a data set associated with a journal that's not a member of Dryad, you can still do it. There's a nominal fee in order to do that, and it's a great place to deposit your data and make it more readily discoverable. The way this works, they have a data submission system, so at the same time you submit your publication, you also submit the data. The data go to a password-protected area in Dryad, so then the reviewers of the paper can actually review not only the paper, but they can go back and look at the data as well. And then you're given the option, most people don't take it, but of having a year-long embargo on the data after the paper comes out. But most people just go ahead and publish the data at the same time and make it available at the same time the publication comes out in the primary refereed literature. So this just steps you through looking at the Dryad website here. The Dryad links back to the journals, so the journals get credit. In addition, they provide citation guidelines so that the data are given a DOI or digital object identifier and can be cited just as easily as the paper itself. And then increasingly, data sets are being cited and are being used in things like tenure and promotion decisions. The seventh step is to define the project's data policy. And this includes licensing and data sharing arrangements, as well as how you're going to deal with human subject and other sensitive data. I recommend the Creative Commons licenses, either CC0 or CC BY as the case may be. And just a simple look at what's happened with the Long-Term Ecological Research Program, which started back in 1980. They discovered that data were being sequestered, not readily available, so in 1990 they implemented their first set of guidelines that were significantly strengthened again in 2005, And now there are over 20,000 different data packages available for download from the LTR network. And as a result of that, making those available, the publication rate has skyrocketed. Even scientists within individual LTR sites or working across LTR sites have discovered that there are similar data that their colleagues possess, and this has led to a whole array of different collaborations and so on, and roughly 20,000 publications now in addition to the large volume of data that are available. And then it's important to describe how the data will be disseminated. There are a variety of ways to do this. Publishing data in something like Dryad or an open repository is certainly one. Publishing appendices or supplements to journals that accept those. Or increasingly, many people are publishing data in, quote, data journals. And there are quite a few of these that exist, and I've highlighted just a few here. Another way is through Data One. Many archives are a member of the Data One Federation, and this provides a simple way to essentially do one-stop shopping for data and discover data that exists in dozens of repositories worldwide. The ninth rule here is to assign roles and responsibilities. And within a laboratory or a research collaboration, it's important that everyone that participates, from the undergraduate all the way up through the postdocs and senior faculty, know what their roles and responsibilities are with respect to managing data within a project. And then lastly, and this is where the rubber hits the road, is to actually have a budget that will support the project's data management activities. And this includes, for example, budgeting for, let's say, the sophisticated databases or ArcGIS for geospatial data, as well as budgeting for the time that will be necessary, for example, to manage the data and the metadata. So what are some of the benefits? I think we've probably seen a lot of these before. We'll hear more about these later this week as well, but certainly the research sponsors and others in the federal government argue that it's for the public good. Certainly, the previous speaker, as well as I think we'll hear lots more about this more broadly, is the need for the public to have trust in science. We've all heard about ClimateGate and some of the medical research scandals that have occurred over the last few years. And by simply providing good stewardship and making data available, we can really make some major headway in this arena. Increased credit, I mentioned the use of data citations for tenure promotion decisions. And then lastly, Cliff Duke, who's in the audience here, and his colleagues have argued that data availability is also a human rights issue as well. So some of the real success stories, I think, apply in areas that all of us in the audience are experienced with to some degree. This was a paper out of the Journal of Agronomy in 2012 looking at corn response to nitrogen and how it's influenced by soil texture and water and weather. This is a large meta-analysis. Again, that allows us to draw much broader generalizations from a whole series of independently collected data sets and projects. Similarly, and this is one that was actually founded, this particular project is called, the short description of it is called NutNet, or Nutrient Network. It's a research collaborative that was formed by Elizabeth Bohr and Eric Seebloom and others who are affiliated with the University of Minnesota. And this is to really delve more deeply into how nutrients and influence productivity in a variety of ecosystems worldwide. And this has now led to dozens and dozens of high-profile publications, including this one that I show here in Nature. A third example is an increasing use of scientific data for management as well as decision support. This is a great example from the on-farm network in Iowa. And this probably is more along the, somewhat along the lines of the clinical trials data that we heard from the previous speaker. And then lastly, this is one that I've been involved in that was tremendously exciting several years ago. And I would argue this is in the realm of Grand Challenge science. This is looking at the distribution and occurrence of indigo bunnings as they migrate up the eastern coast of the U.S. The bright areas are the summer breeding territories, and then as it gets darker, that's when the birds have essentially migrated down into South or Central America, as the case may be. But this particular study really depended upon access to data that were collected by over 30,000 citizen scientists. That number has grown immensely. The current state of the birds reports involve data that are collected by well over 100,000 citizen scientists worldwide, and that number continues to grow, as well as all the various and sundry other data that are necessary to look at some of these big, challenging questions. In this case, it depended on soils, meteorological data, remotely sensed data. There were 30 different data layers that went into this pretty sophisticated set of analyses. So I want to leave this up here for just a second. These are the references to the two papers that largely made up the material that I presented in this particular talk. The 10 Simple Rules was just published in PLOS Computational Biology, and then Stephanie Hampton and I and several of our colleagues published the Tao of Open Science for Ecology and Ecosphere this year. And then for those of you that are interested in more about best practices or learning more about Data One, I would encourage you to go to our website. We have lots of education and training materials there. We also provide webinars on a monthly basis that cover all aspects of open science, as well as tools and approaches that you can use. So with that, I will thank you very much and make room for Cynthia.